Hello and welcome to Eye on Princeton. This podcast is dedicated to informing city residents like you about the happenings here in Princeton, Texas. Each episode will help you find the things you need to know to navigate in and around the city. We keep our eye out for businesses that are coming to town, road construction updates, city ordinances, and public safety. We also like to highlight local residents that live in the city. Right now, we'll hand things off to your host and Princeton resident, Mitchell Chase.
Greg Price, thank you very kindly for those nice words and that introduction. We have another episode of Eye on Princeton. We're going to bring on right now the fire marshal for the city of Princeton, Greg Fenn. Fire Marshal Fenn, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
I thought maybe where we'd start is, what is the role of the fire marshal in the city of Princeton?
My job is a very interesting job. Not only do I have to deal with just the fire and life safety aspects, but I do the plan reviews, the annual inspections, public education, and have to enforce a fire code and work side by side very well with the development services to cover all the growth that we have and new construction we have in town. So it's a very busy position that requires me and my part-time crew to wear many hats.
When you see the growth that's happening in Princeton, and I look at what you just said, your workload has got to be huge.
Oh, yes. It's continued to at least double each year. I've been here for a little over 5 years and been implementing more modern codes and such on it. And it's been very challenging at times, but it's been very rewarding seeing some of the growth that we have, as well as knowing that the buildings are as safe as possible for a resident as well as visitors and everybody in town.
Let's talk residential property for a minute. And with the new construction, has technology evolved such that they're safer than they were years ago?
Well, safer in general. I deal mostly with the commercial, but the residential portion that I deal would be the streets and the roads, as well as we do for the fire service. We do pre-planning and all that. There's the multifamily is what I deal with when it comes to the residential. Yeah, the construction is still, you know, the wood frame. As we continue to go, the materials that the houses are made of and the furnishings we have actually makes it the fire loads higher, and actually the growth of the fire moves faster. So they've actually kind of gone backwards when it comes to, you know, the growth of a fire.
That's very interesting. That leads me to this, the business side of it. Explain what happens when a new business wants to open in the city of Princeton and they contact you. What takes place?
Okay. Well, they got to go through a permitting process that goes through development services. And like I said, I work really tight with them and we communicate well. So they go through their permitting process, the zoning and that such. And then once they submit the plan, then I start looking at the civils and everything in conjunction with development services. And what I'm looking for is our fire apparatus, access roadways. I'm looking for, you know, if it's sprinklers are required, standpipes and such of those life safety issues. You know, some of our international building code and international fire code, they mirror each other, but it just allows us to get another set of eyes and of that. And we have our own process that as construction phases go, that we communicate with the superintendent, general contractor, and go out there with field inspections.
With regards to the roads and your role, could you go into that?
The roadways, you know, they have to be able to withstand 80,000 pounds. You know, that's our largest truck apparatus. We have a minimum width depending on the height of the buildings around. And as we go, we got to have turnarounds if it's a dead end or little things so we can maneuver apparatus. We take into account that the cars parked on the side in places. So we want to be able to safely operate the emergency equipment as well as, you know, get there, the access to it so we can help people, as well as trees and stuff and overhangs. That one of my responsibilities is making sure that it's at least 14 feet above the roadway. If not, have to contact Public Works or the property owner to get that resolved.
You wear a lot of hats. You mentioned that at the beginning of our interview, and it's just amazing how much falls on the fire marshal. Do you have an assistant?
I do. We're all part-time. This is a part-time position. So I work here on part-time hours. And my full job is in different fire service. There is at the 24-48. So on my 48 hours that I'm off, I'm usually up here handling some plans or something. But I do have assistant fire marshal, and then I do have a new inspector. I do have a little bit of help. For many years, I was a one-man show around here. So getting kind of spoiled now with a little bit of help.
When it comes to our homes, your thoughts about what we're doing wrong, in other words, in creating fire hazards.
My goal is for prevention, so I want to make sure I educate everybody. Most common fire in a home is a cooking fire, usually in the kitchen. And that's around, I believe it's close to 50%, 48% or so of reported residential fires are caused there. And it's also kind of important because it's like the second leading cause of deaths in a home.
Wow.
Most of those are basically from unintended food, start something, walk away from it, think it's only going to be a matter of be gone a moment, and then laundry gets a phone call or something, and then the stuff will flame up.
We need to be diligent and careful when we're in the kitchen. Don't leave something cooking and walk away and have that flame going, or the, if you have an electric stove, have that going.
Yes, sir. Whether it's electric or gas, there's still a heat source, so it's still going to cause, smoking and all that, especially, a lot of or with oils and stuff. So, anything that's over like 375 degrees, it starts smoking up quite a bit. And if it doesn't get there, it's going to get to the flash point. It's going to start igniting and cause a problem. And, I've had it where people try to get the pans and stuff out. The best thing to do is if you do have a grease fire or a cooking fire, is to turn off the heat source. That's the first thing. And then what you do, you go and you get a lid. If you got the lid of the pot, whatever, just put that on it, and that'll smother it. Another one, if you don't have a fire extinguisher, which is recommended that you do have one of the little kitchen fire extinguishers in your kitchen, is you can pour baking soda over it. But the thing is, I've had people go and, they know it's a white powder that needs to put on it, but they throw flour on it and flour will blow up in your face. You want to make sure, you can do that. And if you have any questions, then just leave the house and call 911. And, the sooner we get notified, the faster we can get there and extinguish it. Normal thing with grease fire, you don't want to put water on it, of course, and don't grab the pot, try to run outside. People can get burned with it splashing around, and then nobody likes to get burned.
Very interesting about the flour, not to confuse flour with the baking soda. That's huge.
Yeah, that's a common mistake people have made in my little over 25 years. Other things with the house is heating, portable heaters. Especially with all the ice ages we've been having here in Texas, you want to make sure if you got a portable heater that I recommend the ceramic or the oil-filled radiator one.
Yes.
The Element ones, the little toaster-looking ones. You get those too close to any type of combustibles, be a couch, a chair, boxes, or your kids tossing dirty clothes near them. That has the potential of causing a fire and stuff too, and I've seen that quite a bit. Another one are electrical fires, not just like appliances, but you have with extension cords and stuff. And a lot of people will go to the Dollar Generals and all that. Like I said, I'm not dogging them. It's just those are just little inexpensive cords. And, it's best to look for a UL listing, Underwriters Laboratory listing of electrical components.
Okay, UL.
The UL listing. Yes, sir. And that's about, electrical fires count for, I believe, about 10% or so of residential fires. And it goes about 18 to 20% deaths involved or caused from electrical fires in a house of some sort. Yeah, a couple of the other ones are, smoking is still hazardous. It's been hazardous, to your health, but very common for people that are smoking indoors or even outdoors. It's a small cigarette going and you set it down, the wind blows it off. It blows it off in mulch, blows it off between your deck and your house. I've seen it where knocked over an ashtray, didn't realize it, or dumped the ashtray in the trash and it ignites it off. And those caused a lot of, higher number of deaths. About 23%, because most of the time people will go or leave it burning and go to sleep. A very common hazard in a house if they're a smoker. Another one is a pretty big one nationwide is candles. Everyone loves candles. Everyone loves the little smell and everything and, the little flickering of the flames and stuff. Yeah. But just want to do it safe. Keep it away from combustible materials. It's less than 5% on the deaths and stuff, but it does a lot of property damage. It goes and you want to keep it away from the curtains. That's a big one. So put near a curtain or whatever, ignite off it, so you want to make sure. And then about 12 inches away is best from candles and stuff. And then experience, I've had is those gel candles. No, those are very dangerous, so you always want to try to stick with the wax candles.
Okay.
The gel ones have gone, and they've had some recalls on them, but you light them, and then they get up real hot, and the container fractures and breaks, and then the gel just spreads out everywhere and causes a big uncontrolled flame. So you want to make sure I recommend sticking with the wax candles.
Very good. I was talking to some fellow residents and about the fact that I was going to have an opportunity to interview you, and this is a big question. When do you shut someone down?
When do I shut somebody down?
Yeah.
Like,
well, let's just,
commercial property?
Yeah, let's go to commercial. Like when you go, okay, you're in violation, we're closing you.
You know, for me to do that, they have to exhaust every means. I try to work with everybody. So I know there's been a couple incidents throughout town over my tenure that I have had to close places down. And it's basically from just when they have gross life safety issues. Some of them I have tried to open before they're ready. Some of them have had an abundance of fire load and not a proper working fire system. I know Walmart has been a troubled one in town. I've got some flack from it, and that's okay because I'm like the big bad wolf in town, and I'm okay with that. Just when there's not a fire suppression system in there, the fire load in a building, like I said, we can use Walmart because I know that's a recent one. You go in there, the fire system has frozen because of the cold. It's not operating, so there's no fire protection at all in there, whether it's in the automotive, whether it's in the main store or any other spot. And years ago, we had that arson case in Walmart that lit off and heavy black smoke coming out of there. If somebody's in there, I want them to be able to get out safely, and I don't want to have a fatality. Those would be the incidents where I step up and shut them down, where basically there's life safety and fire life safety issues.
Understood. So if you see something that's in violation, you try to give them an opportunity to correct it, come back, inspect it, and make sure everything's okay. But it's when somebody neglects taking care of it, that's when you step in.
I'd rather educate people instead of finding them or citing them and, finding them or shutting them down. I use my little more discretion in my experience to communicate and educate people on many things. And some of it may be a minor thing and they just overlooked it. So on that, I try to work with them. I work with new builders as well as the existing commercial properties. I have no problem assisting anyone in their needs. I'm a working man also. I understand we got to stay open and keep everybody happy, but I got to also keep everyone safe.
Yes, you do. And thank you to you and your team for doing just that. Before we go, I would be remiss if I didn't discuss your smoke detectors and the CO. And could you explain where, just to make sure it's clear, where to put the different detectors? And since we just passed daylight savings time, is a good time to change your batteries?
On the older ones, yes. Now they have some 10-year batteries and 7 to 10 years smoke detectors. I recommend still test them, make them beep once a month. But yes, that is a normal thing. And per the residential code, you have to have one outside of each bedroom as well, in the hallway and also inside each bedroom. You want to make sure they work. You want to make sure that they function. If you have any questions, you're welcome to call me, call the fire department. We'll check it out for you. But it's highly important that, because they do save lives. They're designed to go off all at once. So, it's common to, if one goes off, you're going to hear all the beeping everywhere. That's to wake everybody up. But yes, those are the main places for them. Sometimes they're required to have a heat detector or something up in an attic space. It just depends on the occupancy. And then, you have your CO ones. There's debate still if it's a high or a low. If you're concerned about it, you got gas appliances, I'd recommend getting a digital one that just plugs in the outlet that gives you a digital reading. Otherwise, there's that combination smoke and CO. So you can just go there and it has different chirps. So if you look on the back of your detector, have a breakdown of what the beeping is. If you got a constant beeping, a beeping, three beeps, and in a minute, and three beeps, or the single beep, everyone knows what a single beep is. That usually means that it's low battery, and it usually only happens about 3 o'clock in the morning when you're sleeping.
Exactly. When it comes to the carbon monoxide, where do you want to put those detectors?
Those are usually like in common hallway. Like I said, there's a lot of the newer homes that have the combination ones. So you may have three or four throughout your home, and you don't even realize it. That's why you have to look. You look up on top, and there'll be a little different icon up there that'll say CO, and so you can look and identify your detectors. And then, like I said, on the back of the detector or your owner manual, often your paperwork that the builder gave you should have it in there where you can go and you find out what the beeping is. So it'll have the same similar beep, but it'll have a different pattern. But otherwise, like I said, recommend I put them on low on a hallway, common hallway, and the digital ones. They're best because they give you the parts per million.
Fire Marshal Greg Fenn from the city of Princeton, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to be on Eye on Princeton. Thank you.
Yes, sir. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Eye on Princeton, a podcast focused on the happenings in Princeton, Texas. We always welcome your feedback, ideas, suggestions, comments, or questions by email to MitchellChase@MitchellMChase.com. Until next time. Blessings to you and yours. Eye on Princeton is produced by Chase Productions. Copyright 2022.